Chapter 3. "Looks like we've got some company," Wofford said, pointing off the fishing boat's stern toward the horizon. Though Teresa had already spotted the aircraft, Wofford's words made everyone else aboard the boat stop and look. The stubby silver helicopter was approaching from the west, and there was no mistaking its beeline path directly toward them. The fishing boat was cruising toward the eastern shore with its survey gear tailing behind, the crew oblivious to any impending danger. No one aboard had noticed the sudden disappearance of all other surface boats, though an absence of vessel sightings was hardly unusual on the huge lake. All eyes turned skyward as the ungainly helicopter roared up to the small boat, then pivoted and hovered off the port beam. The survey crew gazed up at an ebony-haired figure in the passenger seat who waved a microphone toward the window and pointed a finger at his headset.
"He's trying to call us on the radio," Wofford observed. "Do you have your ears on, Captain?"
Tatiana translated to the annoyed captain, who shook his head and spoke indignantly back to the Russian woman. He then grabbed a radio microphone from the wheelhouse and held it up toward the helicopter while slicing his free hand horizontally across the front of his throat.
"The captain says his radio has not operated for 2 years, Tatiana said, reporting the obvious. "He states that there is no need for one. He sails efficiently without it."
"Now why does that not surprise me?" Roy said, rolling his eyes.
"He obviously wasn't in the Boy Scouts," Wofford added.
"It looks like they want us to turn around," Teresa said, interpreting new motions from the helicopter co-pilot. "I think they want us to return to Listvyanka."
"The helicopter is from the Limnological Institute," Tatiana noted.
"They have no authority. We can ignore them."
"I think they are trying to warn us," Teresa protested, as the helicopter dipped its rotors several times while the passenger continued making motions with his hands.
"We're probably intruding on an insignificant experiment of theirs," Tatiana said.
Shooing her arms at the helicopter, she yelled,
"Odvut! Odvut! Go away!"
Jordino peered out the cockpit windshield and grinned in amusement. The crusty captain of the fishing boat appeared to be yelling obscenities at the helicopter while Tatiana stood shooing them away.
"Apparently, they don't like what we're selling," Jordino remarked.
"I think their captain is either short on brains or long on undistilled vodka," Pitt replied, shaking his head in frustration.
"Could be your lousy Marcel Marceau imitation.
Take a look at the waterline on that bucket." Jordino studied the port side hull of the fishing boat, noting that it rode low in the water.
"Looks like she's sinking already," he said.
"She won't have much chance against a 30-foot wave," Pitt remarked. "You're going to have to put me on the deck." Jordino didn't bother questioning the wisdom of the request or protesting the danger to Pitt. He knew it would be a futile gesture. Pitt was like an overgrown Boy Scout who wouldn't take no for an answer when helping an old lady across the street. He would put his own safety last in order to help others, regardless of the risk. With a steady hand on the controls, Jordino inched the helicopter in a tight circle around the boat, searching for a spot he could touch down and offload Pitt. But the old vessel would not cooperate. A tall wooden mast ran up from the wheelhouse a dozen feet, shielding the boat like a lance. With its 42-foot diameter rotors, there wasn't a place on the boat the helicopter could hover without striking the mast.
"I can't get in tight enough with that mast. You'd have to swim it or risk a 20-foot drop without breaking a leg," Jordino said.
Pitt surveyed the derelict black boat with its crowd of occupants who still stared up in confusion.
"I'm not ready for a swim just yet," he said, contemplating the frigid lake water. "But if you can put me on that mast, I'll do my best fireman's imitation."
The thought seemed crazy, Jordino thought, but he was right. If he could maneuver the helicopter up tight to the mast from above, Pitt could grab hold and slide down to the deck. A tough enough maneuver over land, Giordino knew the attempt over a moving and rocking boat could knock the chopper out of the sky if he wasn't careful. Pulling the Kamov up till its wheels hung 10 feet above the mast, Giordino gently inched the helicopter forward until its passenger door was directly above the mast. Lightly stroking the throttle control, he adjusted the chopper's speed until it precisely matched that of the moving boat. Satisfied he was tracking together, he slowly lowered the helicopter until it hung just 3 feet above the mast. "With the boat rocking, I'll have to take just a quick dip to get you down," Giordino said through the headset. "Sure you can climb back up so I can pull you off?" "I'm not planning on coming back," Pitt replied matter-of-factly. "Give me a second and I'll guide you down." Pitt took off his headset, then reached down and pulled out the red duffel bag at his feet. Opening the cockpit door to a rush of air from the rotors, he casually tossed the bag out, watching it land with a bounce on the wheelhouse roof. Pitt then dangled his feet out the door and motioned with one hand for Giordino to hold steady. The mast swung brusquely back and forth from the rocking motion of the boat, but Pitt quickly got a feel for the rhythm. When it slowed between swells, Pitt dropped his palm to Giordino. The pilot instantly dipped the helicopter 3 feet, and in a flash, Pitt was gone out the door. Giordino didn't wait to see if Pitt had successfully connected with the mast, but immediately lifted the helicopter up and away from the fishing boat. Gazing out the side window in relief, he saw Pitt with his arms grappled to the top of the mast, slowly sliding his way down. "Vereshchagin to airborne unit. Over," burst the voice of Rudy Gunn through Giordino's ears.
"What's up, Rudy?"
"Just wanted to give you a status on the wave. It's now traveling at 135 miles per hour, with a wave height cresting at 34 feet. It is past the Selenga River Delta, so we expect no further increases in velocity before it reaches the southern shoreline."
"I suppose you call that the good news. What's the current ETA?"
"For your approximate position, 18 minutes. The Vereshchagin will turn to align itself to the wave in 10 minutes. Suggest you stand by for emergency relief."
"Rudy, please confirm. 18 minutes to arrival?"
"Affirmative."
18 minutes. It was nowhere near enough time for the dilapidated fishing boat to reach safe haven. Staring at its black hull skimming low in the water, he knew that the old boat had no chance. With a gnawing sense of dread, Giordino realized he might have just given his old friend a death warrant by dropping him to her decks below. Pitt clung to the mast crossmember momentarily, eyeing a pair of worn GPS and radio antennas sprouting just inches from his face. Once Giordino pulled the helicopter away and the air deluge from its rotors subsided, he casually slid down the mast, using his feet as brakes to slow his descent. Grabbing his duffel bag, he stepped across the wheelhouse roof and down a stepladder at its stern edge. Dropping to the deck, he turned and faced the group of shocked people staring at him with open mouths.
"Privet." He grinned disarmingly. "Anyone here speak English?"
"All of us but the captain," Teresa replied, surprised like the others that Pitt was not Russian.
"What is the meaning of this intrusion?" Tatiana demanded tersely.
Her dark eyes surveyed Pitt with a look of distrust. Behind her, the fishing boat's captain stood in the wheelhouse door and launched an equally contemptuous tirade in his native tongue.
"Comrade, tell your captain that if he ever wants to hoist another vodka, he had better get this tub turned toward Listvianka at full speed and right now," Pitt replied in a commanding tone.
"What's the trouble?"
Teresa asked, trying to thaw the tension.
"An underwater landslide has triggered a large freak wave near Alcon Island. A 30-foot wall of water is bearing down on us as we speak. Emergency radio broadcasts were issued across the lake, but your good captain was incapable of hearing the warning."
Tatiana had an ashen look on her face as she spoke rapidly to the captain in a hushed tone. The captain nodded without saying a word, then climbed into the wheelhouse. A second later, the boat's old motor whined in protest as the throttle was pushed to its stops and the bow eased around toward Listbianca. On the stern deck, Roy and Wofford were already yanking in their survey gear as the boat slowly accelerated. Pitt looked up and was disturbed to find that Giordino had flown away from the fishing boat, the silver helicopter now skimming west rapidly toward the horizon. If the boat couldn't outrun the wave to safety, which was a certainty, then he wanted Giordino standing by above them. Silently, he cursed himself for not bringing a handheld radio with him. "Thank you for flying out to warn us," Teresa said, approaching Pitt with a nervous smile and a handshake. "It was a dangerous way to come aboard." She had a warm honesty that reminded Pitt of his wife, Lauren, and he decided that he liked the Dutch woman immediately. "Yes, we are grateful for the alert," Tatiana said, apologizing for the earlier inquisition in a slightly warmer tone. Making quick introductions, she asked, "You are from the Limnological Institute research ship, no?" "Yes. They're headed to Listbianca, along with the other vessels at this end of the lake. Yours was the only one we couldn't alert by radio." "I told you there was something wrong with his boat," Wofford whispered to Roy. "Something wrong with the captain, too," Roy replied with a shake of the head. "Mr. Pitt, it appears that we will be riding the wave out together. How much time do we have before it will reach us?" Tatiana asked. Pitt glanced at his orange-faced Doxa dive watch. "Less than 15 minutes, based on the rate it was traveling when I left the Vereshchagin." "We'll never make it, the Listvianka," Tatiana quietly assessed. The lake broadens at the southern end, which will dissipate the wave toward the west. The closer we get to Listvianka, the smaller the wave we'll have to navigate. But standing on the deck of the leaky fishing boat, Pitt secretly had doubts whether they could navigate a puddle. The old boat seemed to ride lower in the water by the minute. Its engines sputtered and coughed as if it would die at any moment. Wood rot was evident everywhere, and that was just what was visible above decks. Pitt could only imagine the feeble state of the timbers hidden below. "We better prepare for a wild ride. Life jackets on, everyone. Anything you don't want lost over the side should be secured to the deck or gunnels." Roy and Wofford quickly tied down their survey equipment with Teresa lending a hand. Tatiana rummaged around in the wheelhouse a few minutes, then returned on deck with an armful of aged life preservers. "There are only 4 life jackets aboard," she announced. "The captain refuses to wear one, but we are still short a jacket," she said, eyeing Pitt as the odd man out. "Not to worry. I brought my own," Pitt replied. While the survey team fastened their life jackets, Pitt kicked off his shoes and outer clothes and immodestly slid into a neoprene dry suit he pulled from his duffel bag. "What's that noise?" Teresa asked. Almost imperceptibly, a distant rumble echoed lightly across the lake. To Pitt, it sounded like a freight train rounding a faraway mountain curve. The rumble held constant, however, and grew ever so slightly louder. Pitt knew without looking that their reprieve was over. The wave must have increased speed, and with it, power, as it raced toward them, bearing down earlier than Rudy had estimated. "There it is," Roy yelled, pointing up the lake. "It's huge," Teresa gasped, shocked at the sight. The wave wasn't a cresting, white-capped breaker of the kind that surfers relish, but rather an oddly smooth cylinder of liquid that rolled from shore to shore like a giant rolling pin. Even from a distance of 20 miles, the men and women on the fishing boat could see that the wave was massive, standing nearly 40 feet high. The surreal image of the moving wall of water accompanied by its odd rumble caused everyone to freeze and stare in awe.
everyone but Pitt. Tatiana, tell the captain to turn the bow into the wave, he ordered. The crusty captain, his eyes the size of a pair of hubcaps, quickly swung the wheel over. Pitt knew the odds were stacked against the aged and waterlogged vessel, but as long as there was hope, he was determined to try to keep everyone alive. The first challenge was to keep everyone aboard. Scanning the deck, Pitt zeroed in on an old fishing net coiled against the starboard side gunwale. Jim, give me a hand with that net, he asked of Wofford. Together they dragged the coiled net across the deck and pushed it against the back bulkhead of the wheelhouse. As Wofford wrapped one end around the starboard railing, Pitt secured the opposite end to a port stanchion.
What is that for? Teresa asked.
When the wave approaches, everyone lie down and grab a tight hold of the net. It will act as a cushion and hopefully keep everyone from taking an undesired swim in the lake. As the captain nosed the bow toward the approaching wave, the three men and two women took up positions in front of the net. Roy sided up to Pitt and whispered out of earshot of the others.
A game effort, Mr. Pitt, though we both know this old derelict isn't going to make it.
Never say die, Pitt whispered back with an odd look of confidence. The rumbling bellow from the moving water grew louder as the wave approached within 5 miles. There were just minutes to go before it would strike the boat. The occupants all braced for the worst, some praying silently while others contemplated death with grim determination. Against the roar of the water, nobody detected the sound of the approaching helicopter. The come-off was barely 100 yards off the port flank when Wofford looked up and blurted, "What the heck?" All eyes darted from the approaching wave to the helicopter and back, and then did a double take. Dangling beneath the chopper on a 20-foot cable was a white cylindrical object that swayed just a few feet above the waves. The object was clearly taxing the lifting ability of the helicopter, and everyone but Pitt figured that the helicopter pilot had lost his mind. At this dire point in time, why would he be trying to transport some machinery to the fishing boat? A broad grin spread over Pitt's face as he recognized the bulky object twisting beneath the helicopter. He had nearly tripped over it while leaving the Vereshchagin just a short time ago. It was the research ship's decompression chamber, on board as a security measure in case of a diving accident. Giordino had hastily realized it could act as a submersible for the fishing boat's crew to take haven in. Jumping to his feet, Pitt waved at Giordino to lower the chamber to the boat's stern deck. With the Seiche wave bearing down on the boat, Giordino moved in rapidly, hovering high over the stern until the swaying chamber stabilized. With a sudden dip and a crunch, the one-ton chamber descended from the sky and collided with the deck. The four-person hyperbaric chamber took up the entire rear deck space and pushed the boat's stern down several inches deeper into the water. Pitt quickly unhooked the attached cable, then jumped to the side rail and waved a thumbs-up gesture toward the helicopter. Giordino immediately swung the helicopter up and away from the boat, settling in a hover a short distance away to observe the impact.
"Why did he dump that here?" Tatiana asked.
"That big, ugly bobber is your ticket to safety," Pitt replied. "Everybody in. There's no time to lose." Glancing forward, Pitt could see that the fast-moving wave was just a mile away. He quickly unhinged the sealed lock and swung open the heavy circular door to the chamber. Teresa was the first to climb in, followed by Wofford and Roy. Tatiana hesitated, grabbing a leather satchel before stepping in behind Roy.
"Hurry up," Pitt prompted. "There's no time to check luggage."
Even the brash captain, staring awestruck at the looming wall of water, abandoned the wheel and scrambled into the chamber after the others.
"Aren't you joining us?" Tatiana asked as Pitt began to close the door.
"It will be tight enough with 5 people in there. Besides, someone's got to seal the chamber," he replied with a wink. There's blankets and padding in the rear. Use them to protect your heads and bodies. Brace yourselves. It will be here quick. With a metallic clang, the door clapped shut and Pitt twisted the locking mechanism closed. A strange silence suddenly enveloped the occupants, but it lasted for less than a minute. Then the wave was upon them. Teresa sat opposite a thick porthole window and looked out at the mysterious man who had arrived from nowhere to save them. She saw Pitt reach into his duffel bag and remove a dive faceplate and backpack with a small tank attached. Quickly strapping the equipment on, he stepped up onto the side gunwale before a deluge of water obscured the viewport. The chartered fishing boat was still 15 miles from Listvianka and the western shoreline when the Seiche wave hit. Those aboard had no way of knowing that they were struck by the leading force of the rolling wave, its peak cresting as high as a three-story building at impact. From his perch 200 feet in the air, Giordino looked on with a sickening helplessness as the wave piled into the black fishing boat. Its throttle was still set at full, and Giordino watched as the aged boat tried valiantly to climb up the vertical wall of water. But the rolling force of the water overpowered the rotted hull timbers, and the old wooden boat seemed to melt away, disappearing completely under the tall wave. Giordino desperately scanned the surface for signs of Pitt or the decompression chamber. But as the waters fell to a subtle calm again, only the bow section could be seen floating on the surface. The old fishing boat had split in two from the force of the wave, and only the bow section had survived the initial onslaught. The stern deck, with the compression chamber, had vanished from sight. The black-hulled wreckage of the bow bobbed only momentarily, its masthead swaying across the sky before it, too, disappeared in a gurgle of bubbles to the bottom of the frigid lake.